Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
How is it that most of us like to be alone sometimes, but everybody hates feeling lonely? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. There's a galaxy of difference between solitude we seek out and the excruciating sense that we have nobody to truly connect to. Ironically, loneliness can be especially acute when we're in a crowd or with a loved one and still somehow feel emotionally distant from those nearby. As my guest will tell us, our state of loneliness can actually trick us into staying that way, unless we learn to recognize it for what it is and find ways to stay open to the possibility of positive interactions and relationships. Psychologist Guy Winch has written a lot about the nature of loneliness and how social ties affect our well-being. His most recent book is Emotional First Aid: Healing Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. Guy, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
How do you define loneliness?
Well, loneliness is really defined purely subjectively. It depends only if you feel either emotionally or socially or both disconnected from others. In other words, it has no subjective criteria. It's not about the number of friends you have. It's not about the number of people that are in your life, in your day-to-day. It's purely about your subjective emotional experience.
Is it possible to be lonely without realizing it?
The thing is, most people, or many people at least, are lonely without realizing it, because we tend to think of loneliness as the person who lives in an isolated cabin in the wood. We don't think of it as the person who's married, might have a family, might have many colleagues around them on the day-to-day. So it can be very deceptive. You might be walking around with this ache and feeling very disconnected, but never quite put your finger on the fact that you're actually feeling lonely, because the trappings aren't of loneliness as we tend to perceive it.
That's so interesting. So we could say something's off, I can't tell what it is, but I've got a ton of friends, I have a family, and so what's my problem?
Exactly. But what you might actually feel is that people don't really understand me. I don't really feel like talking to this person because they won't really get me. Or you might have this subjective feeling that, yeah, there's all these people around me, but they don't really know me well enough to know how I'm thinking or feeling, or they don't appreciate me. In other words, if you start to ask yourself whether you're feeling disconnected, you'll pretty soon come up with the answer if that's the case. But we don't stop to ask.
I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that married people are not protected by having a spouse from loneliness.
And that's really surprising, but a very large percent of married people report feeling lonely. And what happens there is that over time, and obviously with some couples this can happen quickly, with some couples it can happen slowly, but over time there starts to be this real disconnect. People stop talking. They stop communicating. They stop having discussions about things. They just go about their lives in this parallel way where they fall into their routines and just the same thing every day, but they're not connecting. There's no real passion. There's no excitement. There's no interest. There's no excitement. There's just not a lot happening between them. And so they feel married, and they might even theoretically love their partner, but they might feel extraordinarily disconnected or feeling their partner's disinterested in them or vice versa, yet they remain married and extremely lonely while doing so.
Can a marriage come back from that?
A marriage can come back from that on two conditions. That A, people have to recognize that that is the case, that there is an emotional disconnect that's going on. And then really two people have to work together to try and bridge that gap. Now, I've actually said to a lot of people, you know, if your partner's not aware or not willing, you can try and bridge it yourself. In other words, if you make a gesture to your partner of, you know what, we used to do this thing, but we would go to the museum and have a discussion about it later. Or we would go to the ball game and talk about the game. We haven't been to a ball game in 20 years. Let's go to a game. Let's try and reignite some of those interests, some of those passions that we used to have, that we used to share. literally by doing things like that, by suggesting it, you can start to reconnect, except that a lot of times the partner who also kind of fell into that pattern of loneliness and disconnection will say, you know, I can't be bothered. Let's just keep things the way they are. Not because they're happy, but because they really don't see that it will make a difference.
How often does it happen that one partner feels really lonely and can put their finger on that, and the other one has no idea there's a problem?
Well, that can actually happen in all kinds of situations. It can happen in a situation, for example, you know, I'll just give you a very simple one. I mean, if a woman has a baby for the first time and she's home for a few months taking care of a newborn while her partner is working, mothers of newborns often report feeling very, very lonely. Because from this vital life that they might have had before with either friends or work or social contacts during the day, they are at home during, you know, taking care of a newborn 24/7, essentially. And they can feel extraordinarily disconnected from their lives and from people, and also physically exhausted. And so they don't really have a lot of bandwidth to sit and engage or hear about what the husband's doing. Meanwhile, the husband or the partner, they're out living their lives and continuing. And that can create this real disconnect. And oftentimes, the people I work with, you know, if it's a woman who's just given birth, she will report feeling extremely, extremely lonely. Even though she's connected to her baby, she just feels disconnected to pretty much everything else. That's just one example. But the other example is that people can slowly drift and develop different kinds of lives. One can stay home and be in charge of parenting. The other can have a career. And then when the kids get older, the person who's in charge of the parenting can feel, you know, that they've lost a significant amount of what their life was about, and they haven't replenished or replaced it with something else, while the other person has gone on again to live a busy and peopled life. And so they can start to become this gap can start to develop, where one of them is feeling emotionally disconnected and lonely, and the other is kind of oblivious because they're feeling connected in all kinds of ways and not aware that their partner is not.
Are single people somehow better at building connections with friends if they don't have a spouse to rely on, to maybe take for granted, to fulfill those needs?
I'm not sure single people, and I don't think there's research that shows that single people are necessarily better than that, because, I mean, obviously a lot of single people can feel lonely as well. And the thing about that is, what happens when we feel lonely, there's certain distortions, perceptual distortions, that go with it. In other words, our mind does trick us into remaining lonely, because it tricks us into believing things that aren't true. And so that can happen with single people, with married people. But for example, with single people, once you start to become lonely, your mind can lead you to believe that people care about you much less than they actually do. They'll lead you to believe that, you know, if you reach out to the friend you haven't been in touch with, they're actually not interested in getting together with you. They'll lead you to experience rejections, such as they are, as much more painful, and they'll lead you to be much more dismissive of positive validation that comes in. In other words, if someone's reaching out and says, let's get together, that won't really register with you as much as it should. But if someone says, oh, I'm busy, that will register in a huge way if you reach out. So, and that will, of course, make you more hesitant for the next time, make you more reluctant, make you more distant, and so the loneliness can grow. So it's a really devilish thing our mind does when we're lonely. It really creates this trap that's quite hard to break out of, especially if we're not aware that it is a trap and that we can't really trust what our perceptions and our emotions are telling us about the situation.
Why is loneliness bad for us physiologically?
Well, that's one of the most surprising things that I think people don't realize. People do associate loneliness with an excruciating kind of emotional condition. What they fail to recognize is it has a whopping physiological effect on our health. Specifically, the minute we become lonely, or pretty soon, as soon as we become lonely, loneliness suppresses the functioning of our immune system. Literally, it makes our immune systems function less effectively. And so it sets us up for all kinds of diseases and conditions we wouldn't get otherwise. There's research that, for example, looked at freshmen in college and that were getting the flu shot, and they asked them about whether they were feeling lonely. Now, they had just gotten to college, so A, it's likely they were, and B, it's likely they were for not that long. But they found that the freshmen who were reporting to be lonely had a much poorer response to the flu shot. Their immune systems responded to it more poorly than those who did not. So loneliness over long time, when it becomes chronic, can do a huge, can have huge damage to our physical health and literally our longevity. Chronic loneliness increases our likelihood of an early death by 14%. These are radical numbers. Scientists have concluded that it poses so many health risks that is it is as significant a risk to our long-term health as cigarette smoking. And the problem is, of course, that cigarette packs come with warnings. Loneliness does not. You don't know how dangerous it is for your health to remain in that state. But it truly is.
It's so interesting, the idea that the immune system can be compromised by chronic loneliness, because I've always been puzzled by studies that report that people who have a really wide social circle get infectious diseases less often. It seems like you'd be around more people, you'd be, you know, exposed to colds and flus and whatever else. But I guess that social connection helps to protect us.
It absolutely does. And I think that, you know, it might operate some ways in the positive, but it's much more about what happens in the absence of social connection. Because since we're social animals, that's how we evolved. You know, we are social animals, we're social people. When we don't have that, and again, not subjectively, not objectively, but subjectively, we might have people around us. But if we're not feeling that kind of connection, we literally feel under siege. We feel extraordinarily raw emotionally. Everything impacts us more and worse. And so it really sets us up to experience all kinds of stress in a hugely significant way that we wouldn't if we weren't feeling as lonely as we were. So that alone starts tipping things. And then there's this real, vicious cycle that gets formed in which, you know, the loneliness perpetuates itself, perpetuates the disconnection, makes us more vulnerable to these kinds of illnesses, you know, affects our immune systems even more. And, you know, and the worse we get.
Can you think, Guy, of an evolutionary explanation for why that would be the case? It would seem really counterproductive to allow ourselves to get a little bit lonely and then have that vicious cycle begin.
So the evolutionary ideas about it are as follows. The idea is that when we were hunter-gatherers, the price of being excluded from our tribes, being voted off the island, if you will, was death, really, because we couldn't survive alone out in the wilderness. We needed our tribes, we needed the warmth of the hearth and the protection of the people around us. And so we developed this early warning mechanism to alert us about, you know, the dangers of loneliness, and that is rejection. So we started to experience rejections as very, very painful, because rejections were evolved to be this early warning mechanism about loneliness, because the danger of being lonely was not being connected to the people in the tribe, was risking being ostracized or booted out by the tribe, and that was pretty much a death sentence. So the evolutionary assumptions are, because that was so dangerous to feel disconnected, because it meant that your position in the tribe was less stable, you might not remain in the tribe. If times became lean, you might be the first to go. We also developed this early warning mechanism about rejection, and that's one of the reasons we experience even small rejections as extremely painful, because they really played an evolutionary role in helping us notice loneliness and helping us avoid what happens when we're not fully connected to the members of our tribes.
My guest is psychologist Guy Winch. His most recent book is called Emotional First Aid: Healing, Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. We're talking today about the physical and mental health effects of loneliness. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the effects of loneliness and what we can do about it with psychologist Guy Winch. His most recent book is called Emotional First Aid: Healing, Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Guy, if people recognize themselves in what we've been talking about, people maybe have been feeling as if they've been rejected because there's something fundamentally wrong with them, as opposed to somebody simply saying, I can't meet with you next Tuesday for a drink or whatever. Or they assume that when people do invite them out, that they're not really wanting them there. What can they do to try to shift their mindsets to be a little more open to positive social interactions?
Well, first of all, they have to really examine their own mindsets and make sure that they are really taking opportunities and really trying to search for them, because they'll tend to be a little bit blind to those kinds of opportunities. I was doing a show once, and people were writing in on Facebook, and there were 100 comments on the Facebook page, and one of the people wrote there, oh, you know, the doctor doesn't understand that people like me can't find people who feel the same way. But this is actually on Facebook, where everyone has a name, and there were 100 people who felt the same way right there. But it didn't occur to him that, oh, I can actually just maybe contact some of these people, or make the offer or the suggestion. So we really have to open our eyes to things. And most importantly, we have to figure out ways in which our negative mindset might be doing some kind of self-sabotage. It's very common for people to, okay, well, there's a party, I shouldn't go because no one will want to talk to me. And then somehow they convince themselves, or someone convinces them to go, but what they do is they park themselves by the hummus and the vegetable dip with a scowl on their face, and lo and behold, no one came up to talk to them because they looked positively unpleasant throughout the whole thing. And that only verifies to them, ah, you see, I'm undesirable. So we have to be careful. Or just here's another example, actually. You know, we have these friends we haven't been in touch with, and we'll feel so raw, and we'll assume that that's because we were rejected by them, when that's not the case. You know, they haven't called us, but we haven't called them either. So what people will do is they'll work themselves up to the point, and they'll actually leave an email or a text saying, you know, I haven't seen you in 2 months, in this kind of accusatory way, which, again, quite off-putting, because you haven't reached out before. So why are you being, you know, annoyed? Or even if you had, fine, the person was busy. If you reach out and just say, hey, it's been a while, let's have coffee, you're much more likely to get a positive response. And so we have to be aware that our mindset is going to lead us down this path in which we might sound or behave in ways that are actually going to push away the very people we're trying to connect to. And we have to make every possible effort to get a handle on that negativity and switch it around a bit and make sure we're sounding positive. Read your text messages, read your emails aloud, and make sure they don't sound so negative, because you might write something not thinking how it could be perceived, but actually that could be perceived in a negative way. So switch it up, add the smiley face emoticon, do something to indicate a positive and upbeat mindset.
You say that we should approach others with optimism, meaning optimism that they will like us and they'll respond kindly. Should we do this even if we have to fake it at first?
First of all, to be clear, we have to fake it at first.
Okay.
In other words, look, the thing about loneliness, it's very, very difficult to emerge from. You're feeling terrible. You're feeling like really no one's interested in you. Why aren't people clamoring, you know, knocking on your door or sending you emails or inviting you places? But you have to realize you've been putting out something over time that's maybe pushed them away, or that sounded a little negative, or perhaps you haven't. Perhaps actually people are just busy and you haven't initiated, so neither have they. So it's a real leap of faith that's required to break this cycle. You actually do have to fake it. I'm saying send an email or a text that sounds much more positive than you might actually feel, because that's more likely to get you the result that you want. And people tell me time and again, and I see this time and again that when people are able to do that, they're surprised by the warmth of the response they get. Oh, they were so warm and they were so happy to hear from me. Hmm. And I go back and say, yeah, that's the whole point. There really was no reason for you to think they wouldn't be, except for that loneliness was creating that distortion that made you think that. But there was no other reason to think that, essentially.
We have a tweet here from John who wants to know, what's the difference between loneliness and depression?
Well, that's a very good question. But loneliness is really about this emotional disconnection. And, you know, they have certain amounts of overlap. But depression is more about your mood, number one, and a real feeling of hopelessness in a more general sense. You don't just feel disconnected from people when you're depressed. You feel disconnected from everything. The things that interested you, the papers you used to read, the hobbies you used to have, the things you used to do for pleasure and for recreation, you're just not that interested in doing anymore. When you're lonely, you can still actually enjoy, and people often isolate themselves by pursuing those interests. It's just the people that they're very hesitant with. So it's a different, you know, depression is a much more global scenario. Now, certainly there's overlap, and certainly some lonely people are depressed, and certainly depression can make people feel lonely over time because it does tend to come with isolation. But depression is a much more comprehensive thing that bleeds into much more than just our social and personal relationships.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Betsy in Grapevine. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, I'm wondering about people who actually like to be alone or like to be alone more than they like, let's say, go to a party. They will go once in a while but are happier being alone. Do these studies apply in the same way to those people?
Okay, so that's a wonderful question. And so let's be really clear about it. Because I'm saying loneliness is defined purely subjectively, those people who actually enjoy being alone or who actually don't like big crowds, let's say sometimes introverts or other kinds of people who really do enjoy being alone, or there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Those people are also not really likely to feel in emotional distress in a constant kind of way that lonely people with. They'll feel like, yeah, I could go to the party, but I'm going to have a much better time if I stay home and do some painting and read that book I was really looking forward to getting to, or see that, or, you know, binge TV watch, whatever it would be. That seems like a much better evening for me, and they're truly happy doing that. There's nothing wrong with that. There's actually nothing objectively, psychologically, there's no objective standard that requires us to have this amount of friends or this amount of connections. It's really a subjective standard. So if you're happier spending a lot of time alone and you're actually good with that and pleased with that, go at it. There's nothing wrong with it.
Is there a certain kind of interaction that serves as a good remedy to loneliness? Like, is a long heart-to-heart conversation better than, you know, half a dozen small talk chats at a cocktail party?
Well, yes, because, I mean, it's about connection. Mm-hmm. So a long heart-to-heart is going to make you feel much more connected in depth than the six dozen, hot enough for you conversations that you're having at the cocktail party.
Because I wonder if people go to those parties, excuse me for interrupting, and think, well, this should have worked for me, and yet I don't feel any better. And maybe they're choosing they're focusing their effort on the wrong interactions.
Well, actually, what I say to people is what cocktail parties or those kinds of events are actually good for is to connect with people and then follow up with text the next day and say, hey, let's have coffee or let's have a drink or let's go to the beach or something like that. In other words, to use that platform where you actually can reach a certain number of people, like 6-7 people in an evening, by chatting with them to rekindle or reintroduce or meet new people, and then immediately follow up with, you know, friending them on Facebook, sending them a text, doing something to set up a one-on-one where you can forge a deeper connection.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go now to Raymond in Ferris. Hi, Raymond.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Well, basically, my question, it's not really a question, it's more like advice, and I just kind of wanted to clarify it, and I just feel like I'm lonely, and I'm also dealing with a lot of grief. My mother passed away a couple of years ago. Mm. And so I try to reach out to my family. I don't have very much emotional support. So I found that, I guess, physical exercise really, really helps with kind of taking my focus off of that. And I'm trying to go to college. I'm pursuing a degree. So I feel like exercise has really helped motivate me to kind of lift my spirits and take care of that loneliness. And also I've been kind of experimenting with like binaural beats. It's really like white noise, and it's helped me also as well from taking my focus off my emotions and applying them towards my studies.
Raymond, thank you so much for your call. I'm sorry it's been a tough couple of years for you. Any thoughts there, Guy?
Absolutely. So first of all, my condolences. I am sorry for your loss. I kind of believe in combos. So A, yes, exercise is actually always good for one's state of mind. It's good for mood. It's good for our physical and our psychological health. So there's no way you can go wrong if you're exercising. The combos I tend to believe in are that if you're, for example, running, join a running group. If you're biking, join a biking group, or hiking, join a hiking group. In other words, find the thing that you like and then find a group who does it, because you can't lose. You're basically going running as you would anyway. But if you're running with the same people week after week, at some point you'll chit-chat. At some point you'll identify the ones that you have maybe more in common with or less in common with. So I do think there's a way to combine the interests we do have, the things we are doing, with a more communal or group forum or activity, so that it just, you know, allows us to maintain the interest on the one hand, but gives us some options, potentially, for connecting to others with a similar interest, which is always a good starting point on the other.
Is chronic loneliness contagious?
So that's an interesting thing. We know that people can tell often when somebody's chronically lonely. Now, you can't just tell by looking at them, but if you know them, if they're in your social circle, we can often tell. And what the research has found is actually quite alarming, I guess, in some ways, and that is that when people have followed social networks over time and seen the amount of connections people have in them, then they've seen that over time, lonely people are pushed more to the periphery of that social network. But what they've also seen is that the people who are closest in the social network to the lonely person are also pushed a little bit to the periphery. They're also pushed out a little bit. So, you know, the conclusion of that study and a few like it was this big, you know, headline of, ooh, loneliness is contagious. Now, there could be circumstantial things working there, but it is true that there's a stigma connected to loneliness. I mean, as an active therapist, loneliness is one of those things people have a really hard time admitting to me. They'll admit all kinds of things, tell me all kinds of things, some of which seem to me, at least, way more personal or way more embarrassing or sometimes horribly inappropriate. But loneliness, I have to really kind of force it out of them sometimes, and I'll say, "Well, you know, is it possible you're feeling lonely?" And it's as if I struck them, you know, with an arrow or something. They just melt, and they feel horrible to have been discovered, because there's some shame we attach to it in some kind of way. And that's because when we're lonely, and especially over time, we do start to believe, well, there's something wrong with us. And that elicits, of course, shame. And the shame elicits, of course, you know, this reluctance to engage with other people so they don't, you know, see how terrible we are and undesirable we are. But again, 95% of that is in our head. It's actually not real. So, you know, you have to overcome the embarrassment of it. And you don't have to tell people I'm lonely, but you have to be able to take those, you know, proactive initiatives to try and emerge from it.
I wonder how much to prevent loneliness, you know, this idea that nobody really gets me, nobody understands me. Not only do we have to give other people a pass and recognize no one in the world except you will fully understand who you are, and how much of ourselves do we have to share with other people in order to have a significant relationship with them?
And that, again, I think is a very subjective standard.
Mm-hmm.
I have friends who go fly fishing. It's not something I do personally. I've never fly fished. But apparently there's not a lot of talking going on. And so they get up, you know, at 5 a.m, whatever it is, go down to the stream, stand shoulder to shoulder for, I don't know, 3 hours, not exchanging a word. and come home feeling like, wow, we really bonded. Now, their wives hear this and go absolutely ballistic. Bonded? You didn't say anything to one another for 3 hours. That seems like the most hostile or something thing. Like, you know, like, we would never do that. Now,
right.
So it's a really subjective standard. Now, so it's what makes you feel connected, and obviously the other person as well. But if you feel connected by going and playing hoops with your friends, if you feel connected without saying that much, do that. If you feel you need to really sit down and talk for 2 hours, then find the person with whom you can do that. Find the person that can do with you that thing that makes you feel connected. Because it's fine the other person feels connected. If you don't by doing the thing, then you haven't helped yourself. So figure out what you need. Is it that talking? Is it that sharing? Is it that somebody who gets it? I'll give you another example. Vets, often who have PTSD and things like that, they really feel lonely and isolated. They come home from Iraq, Afghanistan, other places, and the family is thrilled to see them, loves them tremendously, you know, couldn't be more loving and attentive, and yet they feel really, really isolated a lot of the times because they feel like, yeah, they love us, they just can't possibly get what we've been through. Only another vet perhaps can get what we've been through. And so, you know, in that case, then by all means, you need to people yourself or people your lives with maybe other vets, maybe go to support groups, maybe start a support group, but get involved in some kind of way. Because if you need to be around people who get you and the civilians in your life do not, then you need to find, you know, more vets to be around, no matter what your geographical situation is. We can do this virtually. We can do it online. So it's really about, finding the situation, the person, the circumstance that makes you feel connected, truly whatever that is.
My guest is psychologist Guy Winch. His most recent book is called Emotional First Aid: Healing Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. Today we're talking about the physical and mental health effects of loneliness. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about loneliness today with psychologist and blogger Guy Winch. His book is called Emotional First Aid. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372. We have James on the line in Louisville. Hey, James.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi, guys. Yes.
Hello.
I'm actually a marriage and family therapist, and I work quite a bit with people suffering from loneliness. And the doctor was talking about how alarm bells go off in our head when we are feeling lonely, when there's that threat of disconnection, and how that has a survival value. Mm-hmm. And specifically, it sets off our fight-flight response. And unfortunately, our fight-flight response is actually what leads to us being so negative. So they've looked at relationships, and there's what they've called the four horsemen of the apocalypse of divorce. So criticism, defensiveness, stonewall, and contempt. And those are basically fight-flight responses. Those are things that when it feels like our connection is under threat, we do those things, but it ends up pushing people away. So when I work with people trying to get them to connect, we have to first focus on how do we deactivate that response for you? How do we help you soothe, get calm, and then work really hard at advocating? Because I tell clients, I mean, you can tell people to, you know, don't be negative or don't be so, you know, clingy or so pessimistic, But really, that's like telling somebody that has a spider on them not to freak out. So you really, you have to do, and I imagine in this book, I'm looking forward to reading it and getting a copy. I imagine he talks somewhat about soothing, or I hope that becomes a part of it.
Thanks so much for your call. Those are really interesting insights. Do you want to respond, Guy?
Sure. You're completely right. The research he's talking about is from John Gottman's marriage lab, and people can actually look up John Gottman. He's a very well-known marriage therapist and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. That's true in the case of marriage. Loneliness extends, you know, beyond marriage in a way. One of the things I talk about is that in my book is that we make choices, and the tempting choice, even if our fight or flight response is not triggered, is often to avoid. And, you know, for example, they did this research where they had people who were homebound for various physical reasons. They had them visits. One group got visits by a support worker. The other group got visits by a dog. And the third group got visits by a support worker and a dog. And when they asked people, like, you know, which they preferred, the preferred visit, the people that they wanted to come back, was the dog. Not even the person and the dog. Now, I don't know if they told the volunteers that they came second to an animal that drinks out of the toilet, but that notwithstanding, the thing is, the dog is less pressure. The dog is less stressful because you don't have to worry about what you're going to say to the dog, what is the dog going to say to you, is the dog going to like you? The dog's going to like you, it's a dog. And so, you know, we often choose to avoid the seemingly stressful situation, you know, and again, when in a relationship, it is often a fight or flight response that often really refers to conflict. That when people are having conflict, and these four horsemen he's referring to, the contempt and the stonewalling, etc., is what emerges in terms of how couples argue. That's the foundation of that, you know. Of those assumptions. But even in the day-to-day, we tend to withdraw. We'll actually avoid conflict. We won't even bring it up, and they won't bring it up, and we'll just sit there in our misery and like, well, that's how it is. But it's only how it is if that's how we're willing for it to be. In my book, I do try and help people first understand what happens to you when you feel lonely, and then what steps you can take to address each of these things that happened to you. And unfortunately, all those steps, they require an emotional risk-taking and emotional effort. Like I said earlier, a certain leap of faith, because your insides are telling you, oh, that's a dangerous thing to do to reach out to that friend. I'll just feel horrible if they say no. Or that's a dangerous thing to do to go on that group activity. People will ignore me. Your insides are telling you, avoid. And it's that you have to overcome.
So what do we do on the other end of this? Because I've come across folks that I have suspected to be lonely, and occasionally the way that they behave is to be, you know, kind of really dominate the conversation or be a little clingy. And, you know, depending on your state of mind, you can respond to that with grace and kindness, and sometimes it feels a little overwhelming from the other side. So how can we respond appropriately and compassionately to people who are lonely?
So, look, I think that's a very good question. Part of what I really advocate for people is that when you're venturing out from your state of loneliness, you're going to make mistakes. Until you find the right medium, you're going to be either maybe a little too aggressive by talking too much, or a little too, reluctant and seem a little too withdrawn, until you find that kind of happy medium. And oftentimes you'll experience that with people who are trying to venture out, but clearly their social skills are a little rusty. Mm. And social skills are that. They're skill sets, they're muscles. If you're not using them well, they'll get a little rusty, and we have to kind of rehab them, as it were. Now, you can help the lonely person by giving them feedback about that, as you said, in that kind of scenario. And so if they're talking too much and you know that they've been a little bit isolated, interrupt and say, oh, that reminds me something that happened to me the other week, and even it out. Help them by interrupting. Don't just allow them to go on and on, because you're also giving them too much space to do that. If you feel that they're a little hesitant, be warm, smile, try and put them at ease, and then you'll see that if they can relax and be more themselves. And oftentimes they can, but they need that reassurance from you. When I greet people in my waiting room, for example. If I'm working with somebody who's lonely, I tend to do this in general, but certainly if I'm working with somebody who I know is lonely, I will always come out with a smile and authentically say, oh, it's great to see you.
Hmm.
I want them to feel welcome, that it's nice to see them. And that's what you need to do as a friend, as a family member. You want them to really feel like, oh, it's great to see you. It's not like, oh, what's this going to be like?
Right.
But you're actually looking forward. You're eager. And you'll find that if you put people at ease, the true them will come out. They'll be able to shed at least a little bit of their worries, their inhibitions, their fears, their anxieties, and you'll have an authentically better time with them.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Sandra on the line in Southlake. Hello, Sandra.
Hi. Actually, I find some of the answers about my question, but still I would like to hear his opinion about it. I didn't grow up here, and Hispanics, we're more social. And I find my daughter in high school struggling to have friends. Her friends are alike her. They're very similar. And she's always the one trying, you know, to arrange gatherings and see each other, or at least to talk on the phone or by text, whatever. But she's not getting response, and I'm trying to help her in some ways. But I don't know how, and I have to say that I've been surprised that I see, at least maybe the area where I live, that kids are so worried about everything from school that they don't take time to socialize, and my daughter feels alone, and that they don't respond to her. How can I help her?
Thanks so much for your call.
Well, look, that's actually a really good question, because it raises all kinds of issues here. But I can say, first of all, this issue about, you know, the kids are so concerned about school, they don't have time to socialize. I think that's a real problem that's happening in this country. In certain places in this country, I think kids are taxed with far too much homework, for example. The guidelines of experts about homework is it should be around 10 minutes per grade level. So if your daughter, say, is in 10th grade, it should be an hour and 40 minutes a night. Kids are often getting home with 3 to 4 hours a night of homework. It really doesn't leave much time. And so, but kids are then very, very stressed because of it. And I certainly, you know and work with very many high school kids who are extraordinarily stressed about their academics in a way that really is not leaving them much room to have a childhood, certainly, or, you know, social connections and all of that. I don't know why, what's going on with your daughter, but I'm glad to hear that she's actually taking initiative. And so I think that's wonderful. Whether that initiative is being successful, it wasn't quite clear in your question. But what she can do is, if she's taking initiative, if she tends to find, for example, that, you know, there are one or two friends who tend to be more responsive than others, she can maybe segue into more one-on-one meetings or smaller group meetings with people who do tend to be more responsive. The other thing is, if she's invited, let's say, someone in the class to hang out once or twice already, and they weren't able to, I would then hold back and let the other person do the initiating next time. The setup that can happen in these scenarios is, if the other person feels like, I don't need to initiate because I know she will, so I can sit back and just wait for her to call. I don't need to make the effort. They won't. But if they think, oh, she tried it once or twice, she's not going to do it again, it's my turn, then they might. So it's this tricky, you know, social dance in high school because, you know, I mean, loneliness is tricky in adult life, but in high school, everything emotionally, and middle school certainly also, it tends to be much more heightened, and we're much more reactive, and we're very sensitive to rejection and to social opinion anyway. So this can make everything more difficult. But I would also, as a parent, I would ask her, her mother can ask her, whether she's feeling lonely or not, whether, you know, whether she's feeling isolated, whether she's feeling connected. It might look worse to her mother than it does as an experience to her. So I would always verify that she's indeed in some kind of distress in the way that, you know, you as a mother are seeing it, because she might not be on that page.
All right, let's go to the phones. Once again, we have Catherine on the line in Dallas. Hi, Catherine. Catherine, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can now.
Sorry, I'm just wondering how... But somebody who's going to, you know, they're trying to put themselves out there to get to know people that can be so lonely. How do you manage the disappointment that just comes along with getting to know people? Like, people, you want to get to know them, they don't want to get to know you, or they're too busy
we...
All right. A little hard to hear, Catherine. I appreciate your call. I think she wanted to know, Guy, about if someone does say no, they're busy, they can't get together, and you are lonely and therefore sort of vulnerable to that, how do you deal with those emotions?
Okay, good. I'm glad you said that. I really was having trouble making out that call. If someone is saying, oh, you know, I'm really, really busy, I really can't get together right now, you can, I mean, I would, again, once at least, I would say, oh, that's great. When, you know, should I give you a try in a few weeks? Maybe I'll circle back next month. You know, I would give it one more try, at least, you know, and then I would try again in a month or something like that. If you're really hearing, oh, you know, I'm really busy, I don't have time, then maybe look elsewhere. But I think it's fair. I mean, people do tend to be busy. Sometimes we don't really know what's going on in somebody else's life. You know, there can be a parent who can become ill, or there can be problems at work that are stressing them out. They might be having problems in their marriage. You never know. I mean, or sometimes you don't know, and then you can assume, oh, they're just avoiding me, when in fact they're not avoiding you. They're just dealing with whatever's going on with them on their end. And in that sense, I also want to suggest to people that if you don't know what's going on, don't assume the worst, because that's often not accurate. In other words, if you don't know if it's because the person's actually dealing with a real crisis in their work life or in their marital life, and if you don't have the information, it's not necessary to fill in the blank with the worst possible scenario as it reflects on you. Just find something neutral or nothing at all. You know, you don't need to fill in the blanks, perhaps. But people often fill in the blanks with, oh, it must be just me. And there's no reason to think that unless you have some kind of evidence of that. And if so, try them once more, but then move on to someone else who's more receptive.
What about social media? It can be this great tool for staying in touch and having these little positive interactions with people in your life, or it can be like a window into all the parties you weren't invited to and all the cool events that you missed.
So look, I say to people, if you're lonely, stay off Facebook, because everyone's deliriously happy on Facebook.
Or so it would seem. Right.
No one's posting, you know, pictures about how horrible their vacation was or how terrible their children are. Mm. It's always the opposite. So if you're feeling disconnected, stay off Facebook or stay on to contact people or to go to, you know, to groups where you can actually interact with other people. But I think social media makes communication easier. So you can use it to forge new relationships, to find interesting people, to connect to people that maybe are across the country, and maybe you won't be having coffee with them anytime soon, but you might be having a phone conversation with them, and it might feel like a very satisfying one. So use social media to the extent that you can use it to connect, to deepen connections, to find other people who are like-minded. But if you tend to be lonely or you tend to be depressed, it's probably good to stay off Facebook.
Psychologist Guy Winch is the author of a number of books, most recently Emotional First Aid, Healing, Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. He also blogs at Psychology Today and Huffington Post. Guy, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is our associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink. If you want to email the show, that address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.